Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to MidRack, where the Navy MilBlog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Just as a reminder for those who are joining us live, if you'd like to join the chat room with the usual suspects, please do. And as we bounce along today, if you have some questions or some observations you'd like to make and you're too shy to call in, feel free to throw them into the chat room. We'll try to fold them into the conversation as soon as we can. And I always want to give a plug if you come in late to the show or you want to catch up on some previous shows or try to hear this again, you can always get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can set yourself up to get a podcast on iTunes. And let's shoot off and go straight on with the show. We have today two returning guests to MidRaps. For the first half hour of the show, straight from the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, we have Professor Bruce Fleming. And for the second half hour, we have Robert C. or Barney Rubel, Captain U.S. Navy retired. He is the Dean of the Center for Naval Warfare Studies at the Naval War College. Let's just go ahead and pivot on to our first guest. Enjoying the chilly, wet weather there in lovely Maryland. We have Professor Fleming. This is his second time on. The first time we had him on, we discussed his role of teaching tomorrow's leaders of the United States Navy and Marine Corps. Today we're going to focus on another hat he wears, and that is of an author, an observer of the military from his position as a civilian, but a civilian that has been thoroughly soaked in the military as a professor at Annapolis for over two decades. And to do that, we're going to discuss his latest book, Bridging the Military-Civilian Divide, What Each Side Must Know About the Other and About Itself. You can find links to the book over at my homepage, or you can always go to Amazon, look up Bruce Fleming, and that and his other books will become available. Bruce, welcome to MidRaps.
Thanks very much, Sal. I appreciate being here.
Great to have you. We'll start fundamentally here.
Okay.
Why did you decide to write this book, and what would you hope that the reader would take away from it, especially somebody who's wearing the uniform?
Wow. Okay. The book, I felt that I needed to write this book because we have a problem. I'm not the only one who sees the problem, but let me start by sketching it. It's been perceived in the last several years that, go back to the title of my book, The Military-Civilian Divide, that the military feels kind of neglected by the civilian world, and the civilian world has gotten to the point where it doesn't spend too much time worrying about the military. And that's bothersome because we're almost a decade into a couple of wars here. The military, the sacrifices the military is bringing are no less now than they were before, but the military has realized that the civilian world just doesn't invest a lot of time thinking about it. You ask the civilians what's on their mind, and they'll all say the economy. It's the economy, stupid, as we used to say back in the Clinton era. And what that's done for the military is to make them kind of defensive, make them kind of turn in on themselves. So it's produced a negative effect on the military itself. And from my position, as you said in my introduction, my position as the guy who's, I like to say I'm the guy in the middle. I mean, I've been with the military, worked for the military, had a whole career with the military, but I'm not in the military for more than two decades. It's year 24. I'm the guy who sees what looks like a real curdling almost of the military's view of itself. It's become a dangerous view of itself, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But the problem is that again, to go back to the book's title, in this case the subtitle, the civilian world doesn't really understand what the military does, and the military doesn't know how to react to the civilian world. So we have a problem. Less than 1% of the American population is in uniform now. A decreasing percentage of men and women in Congress have ever served in the military. They don't understand what the military does. So the military world has kind of lost a sense of what's going – I mean, excuse me, the civilian world has lost a sense of what's going on in the military. And like I say, what happens in the military is that it's gotten really very – it's got a self-image that is based on defining itself against the civilian world. Let me – you're going to give me a minute or two here to sketch this out.
Oh, sure.
The question was, who's it for? It's for both sides. The civilian world has got to understand what the military does and appreciate it more, or at least understand it more. And the military world has got to stop with some of the nonsense that it's come up with in the last 10 years, 20 years anyway. Let me take those in order. What does the civilian world have to do? I divide the civilian world into, rather schematically, liberals and conservatives. The conservatives, their problem is that they just love the military too much. Anything the military does is great. Well, because why is that? It's because a lot of what the conservatives see as their own virtues are also military virtues, self-sacrifice, loyalty, kind of being hard, and so on. So they see themselves mirrored in the military, which is great, but what it leads to, unfortunately, is a support for anything, any military mission that's undertaken. Now, support for the military is not the same as support for any particular military mission that politicians want to use them for. So you get conservatives, civilian conservatives, who say, we have to support the troops, to which I obviously say, Roger that, but they think that means we have to support anything they're used for. So conservatives have to take two big steps back. By the same token, liberals have to take a couple of giant steps forward. It's like a game of science, Simon Says. You have to take two giant steps forward. Liberals are typically, and I'm a liberal, so I can talk trash about liberals. Liberals are typically either unconcerned with the military or basically don't like the military. I mean, liberal virtues are things like finding yourself, expressing yourself. That's not the language of the military. The military is the language of following orders, of being hard, of self-sacrifice, and so on. So liberals typically have not been very warm towards the military. Most of them won't say in public that they don't support it, but they don't feel very wedded to it. So what both sides of the civilian world have to understand is that it's their military. And that's what who's this book written for? It's written for civilians and it's written for military. But what I'm talking about now is what the civilians have to take away from it. Folks, it's your military. You pay for it. They're there to defend you. You better understand them and you better like them because they're doing it for you, all right? The analogy that I have is that the military is the hammer and the civilian world is the hand. And the military is a tool of the civilian world. As Clausewitz said, war is politics by other means. It's a tool in the toolbox. We use the military under certain circumstances and so on. So what we have now is a basically unconcerned civilian populace. And that drives the military wild. And now I'm going to part two, which is the other people it's written for, which is the military. The military, I'm going to take a semi-giant step backwards here, take a swing at this one here. The military lacks a coherent understanding of what it does now. Let me go back to what I just said. The military is a tool. It works for the civilian world. What sense, therefore, does it make when you hear people in the military say, we are held to a higher standard than the civilian world, we are harder than the civilian world, we are more moral than the civilian world? What that sounds like is we are actually better people than the ones that we are defending. So the military has gotten defensive towards the civilian world. It's a vicious circle. Insofar as the civilian world ceases to really care and be invested in the military says, well, wait, we're doing this for you, and we're actually better than you. I mean, look at you people. You go shopping. You have a second Cinnabon at the mall. We're up by O'Dark 100, you know, running around and doing more than you do all day, and so on. So what I see, not only at Annapolis, but by extension in the fleet, is that justified pride in what the military does, which is a good thing, kind of goes too far, and it turns into actual disdain of the civilian world that they're doing it for. People in the military are actually taught nowadays to believe that they're, in some sense, better than the civilians that they're doing it for. So who's this book written for? It's written for both sides, but mostly, I mean, I can lecture the civilians, and I'm in a pretty good place to do that because I am a civilian, and I can lecture the liberals because I'm in a pretty good place for that because I come from a liberal background. But really, the side that has to do something about it is the military side, and that's because of what I said before. The military is the tool. The military is the hammer to the civilian hand. So what I need from the military is that at the Naval Academy, at West Point, at in the ranks, in the fleet, in the Marine Corps, that the officers are very clear with their men and women that they should take pride in what they do, but that that should not become disdain of the civilian populace that they're doing it for. So
Can I interrupt there and ask you a question about the disdain occasionally shown to the military by people, let's say a senator from Massachusetts who did serve in the Navy, but who cautions people that if they don't go to school and mind their P's and Q's, they'll end up in Iraq. I mean, how about the Harvard intellectuals who have disdain for everybody who didn't go to Harvard? Why is that any different than the pride the military has, the pride firemen have, the pride policemen have? I mean, you could point out any number of institutions in our society in which the same kind of cultural, I don't want to say arrogance, but pride or prejudice comes to play.
I have two sons, 6 and 8, and they both go to an elementary school right here in the area. And their slogan is that we at DES, which is the initials of their school, and it rhymes with the rest of the phrase, which is the best. So they're going around saying, my elementary school is the best. I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with people I do actually have a problem with people from Harvard thinking that they're better than people who go to Yale or people who go to Penn State, because it's not necessarily true. I have a problem also with people who go to the United States Naval Academy saying, oh, we're the best and the brightest, and what does that make the rest of you out there? So I don't see any harm in kind of parochial boosterism, but it can very easily become snobbery, which is the next step, and that's just stupid. I mean, people have to be judged on what they are individually and not where they went or what they're from. But what's really noxious is when it goes a step further than that. I think it's great that if the Marine Corps, for example, can say, or the Navy for that matter, can say, look, here's what we've accomplished and we're proud of that. That is great. I mean, everybody needs pride in what he or she does. But I don't accept this kind of local boosterism where we say, I do what I do, and that makes me better than you. I mean, with the military, it's, I don't care what Harvard does. I mean, I roll my eyes at it, just the way I roll my eyes at what, you know, you'll hear kids from Navy say, oh, we're better. They're not, actually, and we can talk about that if you want. And it's bad when they go around acting as if they are. But it becomes not just stupid, but noxious when it's the military doing it, because you know what? The military is paid for by the civilians. The military is supposed to defend the civilians. So if Harvard, that pays for itself mostly, gets some government grants, but if they want to say, oh, we're better than other people, I don't think it's any, I mean, it's no more or less stupid than my kids going to their elementary school and saying DES is the best. Sure, whatever. I mean, the elementary school down the road says the same thing. And from an adult perspective, it all looks just kind of sweet. But it's not sweet in the case of the military, because we're talking life and death, and we're talking an attitude towards the citizens who are being defended. So the answer to your question is, if it's just kind of local boosterism, and if it's just pride in what you do, there's nothing wrong with it. But when it becomes this negative thing, where they feel that they're actually better than the people that they're defending, that's bad. Because if you look historically, when the military starts feeling itself superior to the civilian world, you get banana republics, you get Prussia at the end of the 19th century, or you get Austria at the end of the 19th century, where the military actually ran the show.
Let me kind of, you know, now we're speaking of Harvard. Let me bring in something a little selfish on my part. You know, people can look back at my archives back when I started this in the summer of 04. One of the first posts I had was on this topic. I'm blessed that I was not born a sharecropper's son. I was very blessed both socially and economically, the position at which I was born in. And to this day, when I go to class reunions, people said, "You did what for a career? For how long?" So I'm hoping if you could help circle, you know, we're talking about bringing people together. When you look back through history, if you look at some of the great Greek philosophers, they fought as hoplites on the line for their city-states. They knew what it was like to hold a shield, hold a spear, hold a sword, and watch their neighbors to the left and right of them fall in battle. The Romans once had a great army, though towards the end, the Romans were too good to fight for themselves, and their armies mostly became German as the Roman elites became disassociated from their own military. You saw in the U.S. Civil War, whereas in our Revolution, our best and our brightest, for lack of a better phrase, put their lives, their property, and their sacred honor on the line to do a Declaration of Independence. And many of our best and brightest, our elite, for a lack of a better phrase, gave their all and their families all in the pursuit of liberty. While in the U.S. Civil War, we saw the wealthy and elite pay for poor people to take their place in the draft. Everybody knows in World War II, you had everybody from the Kennedy family to the Bushes who put their young sons on the line enthusiastically. You saw significant participation at the Ivy Leagues and other major universities here in the U.S. The nadir of the Vietnam War, where the ROTC units were kicked off, and they're still off of many of those institutions. And I know you mentioned them in your book, Nathaniel Fick, his One Bullet Away book. He actually has to explain to people, and I think he describes real well, what it's like to come from a certain social class where to be in the military is looked as a step down, like there's something wrong with you. So we have this full circle where it used to be that those who the most were given, a lot was expected and they participated in, to the point now that the only real interface that we have, except for a few people who do cross town to MIT, to NROTC, or some of the other institutions that still have them nearby, the only time they interface is when the military sends some mid and senior grade officers over for a Harvard fellowship or one of the other similar ones, which is more of a networking and, you're going to be in D.C. for most of the next 10 years. Let's introduce you to our lobbyist routines, as opposed to really getting the intellectual elite invested personally with blood. You know, you sit in a group of 40 people and they talk abstractly about the war, and all of a sudden you realize none of them have a family member that's been involved in this. Yeah. What can we do from both the military and the civilian side to try to get back where we've been before on getting those different parts of culture together?
Well, I think you're doing a great job of actually answering the question that you started off with, which is what, at least the way I chose to hear that question, which is,
sure,
what's the problem that I'm addressing? That's the problem. And that's what I was trying to address by saying, this is a problem with the liberal, sounds like a Sarah Palin word to say the liberal elite, but it's true. I mean, the problem that the ruling class in our country is not interested in the military, and that Nathaniel Fick can get a whole book out of, "I went to Dartmouth and then joined the Marine Corps," I mean, that ought to be a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. But I guess it was bizarre enough that, you know, some agent in New York said, "Wait, this is insane. You got to write a book about this." That's exactly the problem that I'm talking about from the liberal side. And I do spend a fair amount of bridging the military-civilian divide talking about the fact that one easy thing that we do have to do is get ROTC back into the elite universities. There's been actually maybe a little bit of light breaking on that. The president of Harvard a couple weeks ago was heard to make positive comments about ROTC, say maybe that they would look at that situation and so on. I'm absolutely behind you. I mean, it's a terrible situation where essentially the lower classes serve and where the coastal elite look down on it. So that's definitely part of what I'm saying, that I can lecture the liberals and say, "Hey, folks, this is your military. you have to embrace it to a much greater degree. So that's absolutely something that we do have to do. But let me just kind of go sideways on this. I've done some other radio and television appearances on this book, and there I pointed out that this gulf that we're talking about, the divide, which is exactly what you're describing here, it could be solved very easily if we had World War III, okay? But let me just very quickly say nobody wants World War III. What I mean by that is the time when everybody understood the military, when everybody had served in the military, that kind of golden day that you're talking about where everybody from the Kennedys on down was in uniform, we don't want that back, all right? It would solve the problem because we'd have a really hellish foe. I mean, Adolf Hitler was just about as unifying a foe as you could, I won't say wish for, but as you could postulate. And it's true, the country mobilized in World War II. But the fact of the matter is that since World War II, we just haven't had a kind of a general conflagration like that that would get everybody into uniform. So the military has got to live with the fact that it's actually a good thing that less than 1% of the population is in uniform. It has to live with the fact that we're not in and all, you know, everybody has to sacrifice everything right now to stop this huge menace situation. And that's, I mean, let me say it again, that's a good thing. That's a good thing, all right? What we have now are these wars of choice, which are far away. It doesn't help this military-civilian divide. In fact, it's part of what contributes in a major way to the military-civilian divide, that we're now in these two wars at various stages that have been going on for close to a decade, and it's not clear what they've accomplished, and most people in the United States are a little bit unclear what they've accomplished as well. So the military, I need to talk to the civilian elite and say, look, I went to the same schools you did, folks, and you have to start thinking more seriously and more positively about the military. I can do that. But by the same token, like I say, I have to talk to the military and say, folks, you're not going to get this golden age, and you shouldn't want this golden age. So you have to live with the situation we have, which is a very small proportion is in uniform. It's a real thorn in the side of the military, and rightfully so, that the elite schools seem to turn up their noses. And that's, like I say, that's what I was talking about 30 seconds ago and, you know, 5 minutes ago in the program. But we can work on changing that. I can, you know, make as big a stink as I can. I don't know whether it'll do any good, but I can make the stink. But at the same time, the military has to understand that Vietnam is what deep sixed general interest in the military. Name, what do I mean by that? I mean something that turned out really badly, all right, despite the individual heroism of the guys and gals that were involved. You know, World War II was the right war. It was a necessary war. It was a horrible, horrific, violent war. Duh. I mean, wars are violent. But it was a necessary war, and it was a just war. And there are not a whole lot of people who can say that about Vietnam. So the military has to understand, instead of just blaming the civilians for not supporting them and saying, well, what do all those stuck-up guys and gals up at Harvard think they're doing by kicking ROTC off, they have to understand that the military is not going to be attractive to the civilian liberal elite as long as it's used for things that don't have a lot of clear use. Now, the military itself, of course, has no call, has no say in what it's used for. I mean, that's the deal in a democracy. But they have to understand that that's the reason why it's not any more attractive than it is. And I don't want to start a huge topic because we only have a couple of minutes, but a large proportion of my book, Bridging the Military-Civilian Divide, which incidentally, I need to get in a plug for my website, which is www.brucefleming.net. It has this book and it has a lot of associated materials. So that
we fully support all plugging and capitalistic activity.
Okay, great. Brucefleming.net, not .com, but .net. One word, Brucefleming.net. What the military has to understand is that a lot of what the military does makes it difficult to accept for. Call them civilian liberal elite, and I'm going to try to summarize the point here. A buddy of mine who went to West Point has a degree, subsequent degrees from one of these liberal East Coast institutions. He says The problem with the military is that the smarter you are, the shorter period of time you stay in. So a large proportion of Bridging the Military-Civilian Divide deals with how the military has to remake itself so that it is actually more attractive to the thinking liberal elite, and also more efficient on its own terms. And, you know, buy the book for the whole program, but the short version is it has to have more of what I spend my life at Annapolis doing, which is reporters sometimes say, Professor Fleming, what's your goal? And I say, my goal is to produce thinking officers. In other words, not guys and gals who are just going to be bulls in a china shop and go off and break something, but you have to, breaking something is what the military does, but you have to break the right things, right? And you have to think about it, and you have to be able to justify it. So the military is, unfortunately, one of the most inefficient institutions ever created. And like I say, this is launching into a whole new line of thought, but just the general outline. I compare the military to the inefficient monopoly of East Germany. I lived in West Germany when I was a Fulbright scholar, and I saw what happens when an institution, in this case East Germany, got to call all the shots, got to stifle dissent, got to make any claim it wanted to claim. And the military is in that situation. It's on an unavoidable situation because we're only going to have one U.S. Navy, we're only going to have one Marine Corps. But unfortunately, the military is incredibly inefficient and does stifle productive internal dissent to a terrifying degree. So the short version is that the military has got to, and again, buy the book, please, I beg you. About 40% of this book is what the military needs to do to clean up its own act. So it not only will make a stronger military, but it will, along the way, try to answer your question, which is, what are we going to do about this divide here? If the military is a less top-down, a less institution than it is, a less you do what I say just because I'm bigger than you and I have more stripes than you, it would actually be more attractive to the Ivy League graduates. And if it could show people that that's what it did, it would be more attractive as a career. So that's part of my answer, that the military's got to take a long, hard look at itself and say, you know what, folks, we've gotten away with a lot of stuff because nobody's been looking over our shoulder. We have to look over our own shoulder. So that's a huge bottom line in my book. And I think that would actually help bridge this military-civilian divide. If the military could rationalize itself, obviously it's always going to be an institution of power. It's going to be a hierarchical institution, but it can be less self-destructive than it is. The military is incredibly self-destructive, and that hurts me. I mean, I work for them. I love them, and they're ours. I mean, they belong to us. So in a world where the military goes off and sulks, which is what's now happening, what you get is an increasingly inefficient military. So a large proportion of my book is about how the military has to stop the defensiveness, stop blaming the civilian world for not loving it enough. No, the civilian world doesn't love it enough, and I'm trying to do what I can with that. But for God's sake, you know, look at yourself, fix what you can fix about yourself first. So that's one of my big messages.
Well, you've got several really interesting chapters in the book, and I was particularly taken with your some of the questions of leadership you raise, and whether or not for example, the Naval Academy actually can teach leadership. You want to talk about that in the remaining couple of minutes, William?
It absolutely cannot. I've gotten to the point where I say this concept of leadership is the snake oil of the 20th and now 21st century. You know, in the 19th century, every itinerant so-called professor would go around in the boondocks and try to sell people snake oil for all their things. There's no leadership is you can't teach leadership, okay? And it infuriates me increasingly to go to the Naval Academy where we say, well, what is it? Look, we're a college, great. There are a lot of colleges. Well, what do we do that the colleges don't do? And the answer that they usually give is we make leaders. Well, that's not true. I mean, people who go to ROTC at Vanderbilt are going to be just as good a leader or not as the people who go to the Naval Academy. So it's a spurious claim. So that's led me to look at this whole concept of leadership. We have a whole department, leadership, ethics, and law. I get ethics and I get law, but I don't get leadership. So, I mean, I've analyzed what leadership is, and you can break it down. And some of the things, some of the components of leadership are teachable. Some of the components are. This is a little self-serving maybe, but what we all do in the classroom is a part of leadership, namely teaching people to slow down, look at what's going on, and be able to justify their choices. That's part of leadership. But there are other components of leadership that cannot be taught, like charisma, like liking being with your guys and gals, like giving off positive vibes. Those things cannot be taught. And you can have people who are smart as a whip and who are piss-poor leaders. I mean, we have a certain percentage of that in Annapolis. Actually, what we have a lot of is the exact opposite of that, which is people with a lot of charisma, but who can't rub two gray cells together to come up with a justifiable course of action. So what you need, obviously, the gold standard in a leader is a guy or a gal who can run a decent PRT. I mean, you need the physicality. You need somebody who can, you know, get at least a B in the academic courses, which shows that he or she can sort of follow the train of thought and, you know, come up with a plausible argument. And then on top of that, you need, I don't know any other word for it than charisma or aura, all right? And that you cannot teach. You can model it, but you can't teach it. And I would argue that any institution like the Naval Academy that claims that they produce a larger proportion of leaders than any other institution, like I keep, you know, Vanderbilt is my example because I got a PhD there, and they do have a Navy ROTC program, they're full of it. They're full of it. So we cannot justify the academies nowadays. I mean, I've gone on, and this is not the time or place to talk about the claims of the academies. They're expensive. They don't produce any better leaders than any other organization. But that's sort of a subtopic. The topic that we're talking about is whether leadership can be taught. No. Some of the components of leadership can be taught. Some of them can be modeled. And the rest is just a crapshoot. It's just
That's the intangibles that you're always trying to get hold of. And I think it goes along with the old phrase that, you know, you can't build character. You can only find avenues in which to demonstrate it. And, Bruce, I'll tell you what, that is a fast 30 minutes. And I just wanted to remind everybody that Professor Fleming's latest book, Bridging the Military-Civilian Divide. And if you're somebody who is on active duty and you're used to pointing the finger at people outside the lifelines, remember the old cliche, you got three pointing back to you. And I think he brings up a couple of good points that maybe have you look at yourself and look at our culture and some things we could do. And I hope you have a real good Christmas season, if I'm allowed to say that, to you and yours, Bruce. And thank you very much for coming on Midrats again.
You are allowed to say that, and I sure do appreciate it. And the Christmas tree is arriving in the next hour, so I got my work cut out for me. Thanks a whole lot, Sal. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Right.
And just as a reminder to everybody who may have joined us late, you are listening to Midrats. I'm Sal from the blog, Commander Salamander. My co-host, the Evergenial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And just wanted to give a shout-out to everybody in the chat room. We got a lot of the usual suspects there. And if you haven't logged on, please join in. There's some good comments and observations going on that doesn't necessarily have to do with the weather everybody's enjoying right now. Coming up for our second half of the show, we have another returning guest moving up the East Coast from Maryland to Rhode Island. I wanted to give a warm Southern U.S. welcome to Dean for the Center for Naval Warfare Studies at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, Robert C. Barney Rubel, Captain, United States Navy, retired. Barney, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks, Al. Glad to be here. I'm one of those idiots that stuck it out for 30 years.
I think we called y'all bull captains. You have an invaluable use, I think, when put in the right direction.
Just point me where you want me to go.
Hey, last week, and I appreciate for the second year of a row, Barney offered up his Christmas reading list. I'm kind of a geek in a few ways. And one of it is I'm a firm believer in books and reading. And one of the really interesting things with your reading list this year, we had Robert Kaplan's Monsoon. We had Rule Number 2. We also had the 100 Years of U.S. Naval Air Power, which, by the way, got the most click of all the ones on the list on the post. So we definitely have an air interest there. Carrier battles, command decision in harm's way. But you also had a balance of things that had to do with China. And if you could for a second, and when looking at the list, it really kind of reinforces one of my favorite little hobby horses I wanted to get on, is using the past and your lessons identified in the present to help chart your course to where you need to go to next as an institution. If you could just take a second and talk to us how those books kind of work together in that venue.
Well, certainly some of them do. I mean, rule number two doesn't fit in with them. The 100 years of air power doesn't really either. But certainly Kaplan's Monsoon, the Science of Military Strategy, and that laundry list of Naval Institute books that were written by our China Maritime Studies Institute all kind of fit together. And your comment about history, I think, rings very true. Especially, and let me talk first about the Science of Military Strategy by a guy named Peng Guanqian and Yao Yuji. These are both Chinese two stars in the PLA. In the PLA, they since they haven't fought any wars for a while, it is common for officers to find a very successful career path via the academic route. And so these two guys have put together a very scholarly book. And the fascinating thing to me about it is that they try to interpret strategy, the laws of strategy, through the lens of, 5,000 years worth of Chinese history. And they make the point that Mao Zedong kind of, as a practitioner, reflected that 5,000 years, even though, at one point Mao, through the Great Cultural Revolution, tried to wipe the slate clean. These guys are rediscovering that previous 5,000 years of Chinese history. Sun Tzu included, they call him Sun Wu. And it's fascinating to see that attempt to define strategy and derive laws of it through the lens of that long Chinese history and fold in Clausewitz and Liddell Hart and a number of other Western writers at the same time. So I regret, I'm kind of teasing people with this book. It was published by the Chinese in English in 05. I think the first volume in Chinese came out in 01. And Amazon used to carry it, but they don't have it anymore, and I don't know if the Chinese pulled it or what, but so it would take some doing to get it. But it is a fascinating thing to read because you're seeing the Chinese, and this is kind of true for the rest of the books here too, you're seeing the Chinese trying to struggle with defining anew who they are. They're not trying to throw the old away. They're trying to understand the old in the context of the new, or understand the new in the context of the old, I guess is a better way to put it. And I was over there in March. They asked us to come over. I led a team of I took five folks over. They wanted to dialogue about maritime strategy. And you could see this process of them trying to understand who they were. I thought it was fascinating. And Naval Institute book, China, the United States, and 21st Century Sea Power, edited by Erickson, Goldstein, and Nan Lee, that reflects a conference we had here at the college over a year ago. Where we bring the Chinese in. We do bring them in every other year. But you, again, through all of these books, you see this China who is feeling its way forward. I don't detect any master plan for global dominance or any ideology that governs this. They're feeling their way forward, I guess.
Eagle One?
Well, yeah, as you point out in the blog post that you put up, they seem to have focused on the center of gravity from Clausewitz, and you note that in order to really understand what they're about, you I guess you had to read Clausewitz from, as you said, from the entire book. Can you talk about that just a little bit and make it simple for those of us who have either forgotten or never knew about what the center of gravity is and what they're focused on?
Sure. Clausewitz was attempting to define the dynamics of war, the essence of war. Remember, he's writing in the early 1800s, the age of Kant, and the age of reason, and an age of Newton, and he's struggling to not only understand the dynamics of war himself, but he's struggling to articulate it in ways that others would understand, because the way he's doing it, he's swimming upstream. Jomini had written his Art of War, and it was all very formulaic and geometrical almost, and Clausewitz is arguing against that. But, of course, he became this icon in the United States and Europe. At any case, one of the concepts he has, he coined, was center of gravity, which is simply that he calls it the hub of all power and movement. At least that's in the translations by Peter Paré and Michael Howard, and Schwerpunkt in German. And it's basically that the normally, Clausewitz says, it's the main enemy army. But in certain cases, it might be the enemy capital, depending on how important the enemy capital is, et cetera. But it's that thing that your military effort ought to be directed against. The U.S. Army, really bought this in 82 when they came out with their FM-100-5, the operational level of war. And since then, I think it's been grossly overdone in the in U.S. literature, including doctrine. But, that being the case, the Chinese look at us and they want to be like us, so they naturally attach, they think, center of gravity must be this big deal thing. And so these guys chewed on it, so they interpret it. They give it due respect, but then they go beyond. They admit right up front, or not up front, but they get to the point where they say, in certain cases, there is no real center of gravity like Clausewitz talks about, that the military situation may be such that you can't define it in that way. So I give them credit for thinking for themselves and not being – they are neither doctrinarily wedded to Mao, nor are they kind of nostalgically wedded to Sun Tzu and their history, nor are they overawed by Clausewitz. But seeing them digesting all this, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah, I was really frustrated when I was putting that post together, because I did what I'm sure a lot of people did, trying to find a copy of that. Maybe we can pull in a couple of chips with our friends at the Naval Institute and see if they could get a license to, at least put out a pulp paperback in there. Because I think what really sparked my interest on it was, when you're talking about Clausewitz, I remember sharing a couple of beers with some German staff officers in Hamburg, and they're very fluent in English, and they're very frustrated at the English translations of Clausewitz. It's like, it's translated wrong. Y'all are missing it. And you made a comment towards the end that really made me want to grab the book, and I wanted to see whether you could expand on this comment of yours a little bit. You said that one thing that was nice about it is that it didn't have the, quote, crank military metaphysics as it infected our literature over the past dozen years. And I know what that means to me, because there's a lot of these ridiculous terms and concepts that people use. It's like pouring milk in a glass of water. It clouds and stops you from clearly seeing what's on the other end. What are some of those crank military metaphysics that is really gumming up the works, so to speak, that the Chinese work that you saw was able to cut through?
Well, the first is network-centric warfare. Now, that is kind of a passe term here now, but, you know, it was from the late 90s through, you know, 2005, maybe 2004. It was kind of the grueling ideology in a lot of ways. And at the same time, for instance, there was a Chinese scholar who was on a fellowship done at NDU. He was a colonel in the PLA at the time, a guy named Wang Baosong. He later returned to China and ended up as a two-star, I believe, retired. But nice guy, good English. He developed, I thought, was a far more common sense approach. He called it informationalized warfare, where information now powers warfare the way chemicals powered, you know, explosive warfare, or animals powered warfare before that, or, you know, human power was at the basis of warfare before animals came in, you know. So I won't expand on it here, but I thought it was very common sense and practical. And I think you can find, if you just blog or Google informationalized warfare, you might be able to find it. And that's gotten traction in China, and I think it forms kind of a basis for how they think.
There's as long as we're talking grand strategy, there's an article in the December issue of Naval Institute Proceedings by James Holmes and Toshi Yoshihara.
Yeah, it's two of our faculty members up here.
Okay, about whether China's Navy is turning to Corbett and away from the Mahanian view. What's your perception of that?
I sort of agree with that. They're being forced into that by circumstances. In other words, their claims in the South China Sea, and even their claims on Taiwan, not to mention, you know, things that are going on in the Indian Ocean, the piracy work, et cetera. They've kind of abandoned the idea of a big sea battle. But if you read Corbett, a lot of his reasoning about the value of naval forces has to do with being able to isolate the theater of operations and thus causing war to be limited. That reasoning is at the heart of a very important Chinese concept, which is localized warfare under high-tech conditions. So, yeah, I guess in a sense they are turning to Corbett because they have to, because of the geographic realities of where they are and how they're expanding, which leads me, I guess, to Kaplan's book, Monsoon, which I think the value of that book is that Kaplan regards the Indian Ocean and the literal seas of Asia, the South China Sea, the East China Sea, the Yellow Sea, the Sea of Japan, all of that he feels is a geopolitical unity, one entity. And I think he makes the case for it. And, you know, with a single ocean navy, China is Kaplan says, a regional power. With a two ocean navy, i.e. the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, now China is a great power. And it isn't just for prestige. There are many economic reasons and geopolitical reasons why they feel impelled to do that kind of, to create a Navy that can see after Chinese interests in both oceans. They haven't gotten to the point, and I don't think they'll ever get to the point where they're looking at command of the sea the way Mahan looked at it, or that really we look at it in a lot of ways. So I guess, although they have a great deal of admiration for Mahan because he's talking expansion, just and he's telling them things they want to hear in terms of a nation expanding out at sea. But when it comes to brass tacks, they're going to have to listen to Corbett more.
There kind of a parlor game that goes on that can be kind of frustrating is when people are trying to talk about, you know, what direction China's going to. Some people will try to compare them to Japan, Germany as it rose after unification, or the Imperial Britain or America after the Spanish-American War. But I've always thought that you really can't say that China is like this country or that. China is like China. And you touched on that earlier, where they're tapping into literally thousands of years of documented, relatively continuous intellectual and cultural unity. But what's been lacking is a couple of hundred years, they were just in a very dark hole they're starting to climb out of. If somebody really wanted to look at another nation the last 30 years, it might be close to what China is transitioning towards or through. Would you be able to put a finger on it, or do people need to not do that, but perhaps exert a little more effort to look at China as China with their thousands of years of background?
Well, it's not a matter of analogizing. I mean, we have to learn from history, and we have to understand the patterns of history. But, yeah, you're right. China is China, obviously. But I think it is instructive, and this is going to lead me to plugging another book that's not on my list. It is worthwhile, I think, to look at what the United States was doing in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century. There's a new book, relatively new book. It's called The Imperial Cruise by James Bradley, which he's the guy that wrote Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys.
I've read it.
The Imperial Cruise chronicles the cruise of an ocean liner that carried William Howard Taft, who was Teddy Roosevelt's Secretary of War, and a collection of senators and congressmen, and his daughter Alice and her boyfriend. And they set sail from the West Coast and hit Hawaii and Japan, Korea, China, and the Philippines. And this was, and I, truth in advertising, I have not read this whole book yet. I've gone through parts of it. But in any case, this was a U.S. that had just completed internal consolidation and now was looking out. You know, we caused a coup in Hawaii and exited in 1898. I mean, we had the war with Spain. And now we set sail, or Roosevelt sent this ship out because he pronounced the United States must be a Pacific power, and now we're looking west. And the thing was that there was an ostensible mission to this cruise, and then there was a secret mission. And the secret mission ended up being Roosevelt giving a green light to the Japanese to essentially invade Korea and Manchuria, etc., all the while pronouncing everlasting friendship with the Koreans. It's very disturbing, but it is a worthwhile look at how the United States was looking at the world, the incentives, the way Roosevelt thought. And it was compelling to me because I'm more familiar with the history of Latin America. That's kind of where I did my business on active duty. And, you know, the sad history of what we did with Cuba, you know, right and during the or right after the Spanish-American War, what we did in Nicaragua, et cetera, is not something that would make most Americans proud. But that was the dynamic of a young, virile nation who had just completed internal consolidation looking out.
Yeah, I enjoyed, I didn't enjoy, actually. I was really looking forward to that book. I read the whole thing, and I read it over a weekend. I thought there's very disappointing with the book in this respect. It takes what is a very critical pivot point in this nation. There's some good information in there, but it almost seems like he had a research assistant who just got through with postmodernist history studies, and unfortunately a lot of the book is trying to judge people 100 years ago by the standards of some people today, and it really tries to paint America as the source of all evil for the last 100 years, which I think weakens the book a lot because history is a lot more nuanced than that. But I think people should read it simply because it does cover that cruise and a lot of very important things that happened on that diplomatically that really hasn't been covered very well. I'm just looking forward to somebody else covering it with a little more of an objective view of this country than he did. I was really disappointed with the book from that sense. Eagle One.
Yeah, I one of the things that always points out in these when we discuss the Philippines or Cuba and some other relations, we were like the world's worst imperialist state. We were very ill prepared to do that, and we didn't do it well, and we eventually ceased being one for the most part. So I don't know where that leaves.
But you said a very important thing. We ended up kind of being an imperial state, and we didn't know how to be one. I mean, this goes back to the theme of China feeling its way. You know, they're learning as they go.
Well, would they end up kind of like where we are, where we regret, for the most part, regret some of our imperialist tendencies from the 1898s, and a try and, you know, we still maintain some of the gains we got then, like Guam and a few other things. But where do they go? How do they, in the 2 minutes left to us, how do they solve this dilemma as they go forward?
Well, I think the good news is there does seem to be some internal corrective mechanisms. They're very attuned to what people say. Their foreign minister kind of pitched a fit a number of months ago at an ASEAN meeting about the South China Sea, and somebody got on the hook to him, and at subsequent meetings he calmed down quite a bit. Same way they raised a big fuss about the George Washington going into the Yellow Sea at one point, but then in this most recent exercise, because of the North Korean shelling of that South Korean island, they stayed quiet. We understand that there was some internal dissent there, and some influential people said, hey, we need to back off. So I think the good news for all of us is that there seems to be some kind of internal governing mechanism that they see what other people think, it makes a difference to them, and they adjust their policies kind of on the fly.
Now, I was really impressed with the strategic silence that came from the Chinese during that whole evolution. I think that spoke a lot to them and the rational nature that we have with the China right now. And I think that's why a lot of your comments that you've made about, you know, your trip and your experience with our Chinese counterparts is really a good thing, because reasonable nations that are reasonably, you can be patriotic, you can even be a little nationalistic, but if you're rational, you can usually avoid having real nasty things happen. I also wanted to give you a second, the last minute that we have, if people wanted to catch up on what's going on with the department you chair, it would be a good place for them to go.
Well, we have a website. If you go to www.nwc.edu, you get to our master website, and then the research and gaming tab will take you to our war gaming department, our China Maritime Studies Institute, the press, warfare analysis department, international law department, et cetera. So it's all right there.
And thank you very much for letting us interrupt your football time, and I hope you have a great holiday season, Barney.
That's been my pleasure. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Barney.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us, and have a great Navy Day.
Piccadilly.